My name's Richard Stewart, and I'm really not the impetus for this group. My wife is, because she was the first one to pick up Clowns of God and read it. As we were preparing ourselves to come to Holden Village, she says, "You gotta read the book, you gotta read the book." So after I was able to put some other things down, I read the book in about 2 days. That's a captivating story, especially as we then began to figure out how isolated Holden really is. I'm responsible for a great aunt who's 84 years old and increasingly not in touch with reality. And so I had to make arrangements as to how I could get in touch with me if something happened to her. And that's when I found out there's no telephones. They didn't tell me about the carrier pigeon, but they didn't tell me about the day delay in terms of getting a message up here by boat, and then a day to get the message back. And I began to think about the implications of what that book was all about.
I wondered if Morris West had been to Holden.
The book ended in Holden.
That's right, it did. You know, I looked at that again today, and I thought, has this guy been up here?
The reality of the locations and the geography began to ring all kinds of bells for us. So we thought, maybe it's not so bad just to have a discussion about the book. We had some discussions early on with a couple of my colleagues in campus ministry who read the book, and Steve, who was an American Baptist minister, was thoroughly disappointed with the ending. And I could never quite get out of him what he was looking for. I really think he really wanted to see the Big Bang, and the irony is, he was the organizer for the Ground Zero program. And I really was sitting there, you know, dumbfounded that the person who would organize the Ground Zero demonstration would then want a different kind of ending.
Less dramatic if it doesn't go off.
Well, he wanted it more dramatic.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The way it ended here is less dramatic, less.
Yes.
Yeah. Ted, were you surprised at the end?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I love all the little clues about Mr. Atha as you go along.
Yeah.
You know, I was looking at the book earlier as we went through, and he says to, he was talking to Jean-Marie as Jean-Marie is beginning to read the newspapers again after his stroke, and he says, "Well, what do you want to retain? The bad news tells you that the bad news that tells you man is dismantling civilization brick by brick, the good news is here, right under your nose. The blind see, the lame walk. Sometimes even the dead are jolted back to life. And if you listen hard enough, you'll hear the echoes of the good news."
Except for you missed that the first time you read it.
Yeah.
And then you
read
it again
and go,
"Oh, I was so dumb. Yeah. I figured it out."
Yeah.
I thought it was wonderful he was a therapist, because I'm a therapist.
Full affirmation.
Right. This is the first time we've had a chance to talk about the end of the book with anybody, because nobody else had finished the book, and we didn't want to give it away. Now, you felt the end was weak.
Only structurally. I mean, in the author's point of view. I don't know. I wouldn't have wanted to change any part of it. I liked the ending. It was what I was looking for.
Uh-huh.
And I was raised in American Baptist. But when I say it was weak is that he got in and got out of it so fast.
Mm-hmm.
I think he should have got in there and reveled a little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that.
It was almost, and poor choice of words here. It was almost as if the ending were an afterthought, and he was dashing it off to get to the printer in time. That was my only feeling there. It didn't have the same integrity and intensity all through.
Mm-hmm.
His detailing was great all the way up, mm-hmm. and then it was kind of like a couple of swatches on a painting to fill in that negative space.
Mm-hmm.
He was where you wanted to be. He was where he wanted to be. Mm-hmm. Was where he brought it with all of your little clues, mm-hmm. all the way through, that you can go back and find dozens of them.
Right.
But he washed it off with a quick swish, I felt.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that made it even more, made it more of an impact because we expected more.
One of the things was it did not give me any indication as to what to expect when I came here, knowing that I was coming to a Christian community isolated in the mountains.
We might get snow before it's over.
The way it's going. But, you know, this is my first time to Holden. I had heard about this place for years, with varying degrees of commentary. Knew John Schramm before he came, and then was with him when he first announced it to a large group that he accepted the call here. Knowing that he and Mary had some definitive ideas about what community was, about what the alternatives were. And then to come and see it 4 years later, to see where the community has progressed, how they're seeing their role in that, was kind of a loose expectation. Mm-hmm. I think a little more descriptive material about that community there might have jaded my expectations about what was coming here.
Well, Wes doesn't know about Holden either, I don't
think. I'm assuming not. Yeah. But, you know, that quick swash then said some other things to me about hope, about potentials for the future, and probably his next sequel.
Is it my understanding he doesn't need Holden after the epilogue?
No.
In other words, you can disband Johann's retreat at that particular point. So the real details, it seems to me, of their life together may not be explicated.
But can you disband it? I mean, it says for a time we've been given a chance, but it never says
that
we won't come back to that point again.
Yeah, and he says in there when Jean-Marie is bargaining with him something about, well, how much time will you give us? Not too much, but enough. And of course, we don't know, you know, what that means, and neither does that community know what that means. You know, whether it means just a very short while or a longer period of time. All this week and last week, Ted, in your group, some of the things that Chuck has been saying and the Bible study yesterday morning about the folly of the cross, a lot of things, a lot of theology in this book rang true with a lot of those things. Mm-hmm. How does the Christ come again? He comes as the servant. How does he call his people? He calls them, and it is his calling and not their choosing. You know, he says that last chapter. It's I who brought you here. And who does he bring? Well, he brings the crippled girl. And that one we can sort of, you know, get into that one. That one's okay. Then he brings the agnostic psychologist or psychiatrist. She's in that case, Annalisa.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
but she's got some smarts.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah. He brought her for her skills, not for her belief.
Exactly, but when we think of choosing, we think in terms of our
choosing,
or, you know, choosing people of belief, and that's,
says. I'm meeting with Wes.
Yeah, that the people are of his own choice and for his reasons and not ours. And indeed, he says about, when he talks about not changing the Down syndrome child, and again, not coming in glory and as a miracle worker, mm-hmm. but let's see if I can find that.
About 18 pages back.
I had it all marked out. Something about, this is my gift, and
there was a terrific speech in there about the retarded
child. Here it is. Mm-hmm. I know what you're thinking. You need a sign. What better one could I give than to make this little one hold anew? And remember that earlier in the book, Jean-Marie indeed does have a vision of the Christ taking the child and making her whole. I could do it, but I will not. I'm the Lord and not a conjurer. I gave this little mighty gift and I to all of you, eternal innocence. To you, she looks imperfect, but to me, she's flawless, like the bud that dies unopened or the fledgling that falls from the nest to be devoured by the ants. She will never offend me, as all of you have done. She will never pervert or destroy the work of my Father's hands. She is necessary to you. She will evoke the kindness that will keep you human. Her infirmity will prompt you to gratitude for your own fortune, more. She will remind you every day that I am who I am, that my ways are not your ways, and that the smallest dust mote whirled in the dark space does not fall out of my hand. I have chosen you. You have not chosen me, and this is my sign to you. Treasure her. Last week, too, we did talk with a little while with Joe and Molly about this, because they have a Down syndrome child, ones with little tiny Gareth. And because of this, this is a very disturbing book to them, and reading about the Down syndrome child being the sign.
Well, isn't that part of the culture after culture in the veneration of madness or defective or which would if diagnosed Down syndrome children in through time. That's part of many cultures.
What is it?
Well,
to feel they, like a gift of God.
They occupy a special place.
Yeah.
All right. It's a kind of reverence for or veneration of the defect that person has.
I keep thinking of some of the things I've read about Indian culture.
Yeah, Native American has done that.
The person's eternally a child, and that holds a special place in the tribe.
Yeah, it doesn't hold true with the cultures of a more rigorous climate. Desert people would not hold with that. But I mean, it's a re-echoing, and probably for the same reason, it keeps you human.
Mm-hmm. I have some friends, I don't know if they think of their child as being innocent, but, you know, it's an interesting idea. I guess I was not familiar with that outlook.
I don't think innocence is the key line, because clearly mentally retarded people are not innocent, but the key line, I think, is her infirmity will prompt you to gratitude for your own good fortune.
Yeah.
And part of the theology is that somehow or other, love has to be kept alive through the tribulation that is coming.
Mm-hmm.
And the value of a little girl is that she provokes that. And some are going to respond with love and some are not. But I think it's the effect that she has in terms of drawing that out. And I think that's probably why the agnostic psychologist makes it there too. Remember, she has this secret love affair with Carl Mendelius.
Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me that and that she has, in a sense, given herself to serve him in this whole process, even as kind of an unsung heroine.
Even the acknowledgement by Mendeleev's wife that she knows it's there.
Yeah, that's true. And towards the end of the book.
Yeah.
And so she's not jealous. She says, must be a wholesome kind of love.
I like the idea, too, about God changing his mind. Somebody, I don't know, in a Bible study the other day, somebody was bringing that up about, the eternal plan moving, you know, like this, or... I think it wasn't in your group, I think it was in a Bible study. And I was thinking about how many times in the Bible God's changed his mind. You know, how many times in the Old Testament he works things out with Noah and then things don't go so well with people again, so he changes his mind and he's, you know, argues with Abraham about Sodom and Gomorrah and Abraham's able to whittle him down. Well, doesn't do any good because he can't find anybody righteous anyway. But
at least he negotiated.
Yeah, he negotiated. You know, and I think in thinking about the history of the Hebrew people, and God changed his mind a lot of times, you know, about what he was going to do and how he was going to handle things. And here he is, down to the wire again. willing to strike up a bargain with man to give it one more try.
But he always knows the ending. You know, it's like, he knew he could give him a chance with Sodom and Gomorrah, and he probably knew that in the end he'd have to destroy it, but, you know, he gives us that chance to work through it on our own.
I had a different concept of changing his mind. You modified it for me. He didn't really change his mind. He just was willing to negotiate. Was that changing your mind? No?
Well, I think it's maybe the gist of it was that he knew what man was going to do to himself, and that really wasn't his thing to deal with. That wasn't within his...
If the only way, the only concept of God we have is as creator, and since we're built in that image, and in the creating that you do, you twist it, you model it, you kick it around a little, you write something, you edit it, you revise it, you paint, you do the same thing.
Yeah.
All I see him is adjusting his creation. That maybe he's changing his mind.
I was thinking about that, because the person who was speaking was thinking about God having made up his mind once and for all how things were going to be. And we sort of just kind of moving down that track, sort of not having much of a decision in what was going to happen.
I guess I'm struck by the whole thing of what is enough.
Enough?
Yeah. When he talks about, giving us, how much time
we have. Enough, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's been one of the constant themes for the last 2 weeks. And it's something that's been kind of the subliminal message in the economic stuff I've been doing. It's always present in terms of the meals, except seems like there's always more. If you're really hungry, you're going to fill yourself up. The way in which, Holden continues to operate, its power, its, the whole images of what is enough. Sometimes people are challenged to go back and do some things, the lady who sent the carrier pigeons. Some go back and build solar heaters for their homes. It's like an eternal question that keeps coming up for us. How much is enough? At the same time, it's like, how much of God's message do we need to hear before we really hear it? It's kind of like one of those subtle themes that keeps coming over and over and over again.
There's probably no objective answer to that.
No, there isn't.
It has to do with people in a given place in a given time. And
John was talking this morning when he was talking about Paul and the Jews, and he was talking about praying for the kingdom to come. But yet, on the other hand, not wanting it to come too soon so that we had enough chance to get that message out there. And that's sort of what, is happening at the end of the book. Don't let it come too soon, because we want to make sure that, the word is put forth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you felt, but I wanted to read the whole book of letters to Johnny. Letters from Johnny. Letters to God from Johnny. Seemed like there ought to be a whole book of those, The two that were in there were so...
At least an appendix.
That
was part of my...
it's kind of frustrating because the letters are so...
Some of the best parts in the book.
So beautiful. And in this paperback book, one is on page 294 and one was on 304.
But I think there's a reason why they're not...
there, because that as much as enough.
I see the question that he's raising in the letters from Johnny the Clown are the theodicy question again. That is to say, God, the author of evil, God is either permitting evil or sponsoring evil. and most of the other things are related to that. And I can't think of a passage, but it's in a totally different context where that is spoken to, and Jean-Marie gets the same answer that Job got: my ways are my ways and your ways are yours, and there isn't an answer to that one.
Is that when he said the encounter with
Dolman
at the hospital?
Maybe. I can't retrieve the context, but maybe it was.
Oh, that starts on, that's around 368 that encounter begins.
That was the encounter with whom?
Dolman, the CIA agent.
CIA agent. When he's in for cancer and he is not going to live.
The real personification of evil here, and Jean-Marie labels him as such. I know the spirit that dwells within you. His name is Legion. You are not possessed by devils. You are a habitat of evils. But I don't know if it's that of which you're speaking, Ted, is...
No, that doesn't seem to be...
There. That is an interesting encounter, too. I underlined one line out of there as Dolman's going back to his room. And Jean-Marie says, "Sit down, Mr. Dolman. Let's treat each other like simple human beings." "You missed the point," said Alvin Dolman wearily. "We all call up our own devils because we can't live with ourselves." And Jean-Marie says, "You're still alive. You are still open to change in God's mercy."
Well, he tries to do with Dolman here what he tries to do with the whole world in the last dialogue.
Of course, Dolman doesn't bite at all.
Jean-Marie has a little interpretation after Dolman commits suicide that maybe the suicide itself was a form of repentance. I mean, it's kind of a thin thread to hang that on, but because that doesn't follow through at the end either. I mean, we don't destroy the world as a sign of repentance.
But it left me with a kind of feeling that it was perhaps even accidental.
The death of Dolman?
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't stipulated for certain that Dolman committed suicide. Marie only thought he did.
Yeah.
On the other hand, given West's writing technique, for example, the package that exploded with Carl Menelaus. Remember, in one paragraph he's opening the package, the next paragraph begins after the explosion.
Yeah.
So that it might be West's way of communicating that he did commit suicide with that particular method. Because he leads up to kind of a mystery, and then he settles the mystery in such a matter-of-fact way.
Well, I think it's interesting to note, too, that Jean-Marie is not only a man of faith and spirituality, he's pretty good in the realm of politics. I mean, he's managed to make, he says, what is the papacy but politics, and making acquaintances and friendships among the world powers, and counting on those people, even though most of them probably are not Christian, to listen to what he has to say about his vision and warning them and trying to get them together.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting to see what happens to those people as we meet Dumachal and brief glimpses of the Soviet ambassador too in the story, and how they're tugged and pulled around in that political arena. And also how Jean-Marie's concerned with their souls as well as their political trying to get grain for Russia. But I think he knows that ultimately that's not going to do it anyhow. I think there's a sense of despair about trying to deal with all of that, although he's willing to try to make the intercessions for that kind of stuff to happen.
Well, now I think that leads to... that's a point, and it's closely related to another point. There's one passage that is repeated three times in the book. The first one appears on page 35. These are the words of Jean Marie. The question is, how are people going to behave if they know that doom is imminent? You know, you've just spoken to that. Mm-hmm. But Jean Marie's words are, it is clear that in the days of universal calamity, the traditional structures of society will not survive. There will be a ferocious struggle for the simplest needs of life, food, water, fuel, and shelter. Authority will be usurped by the strong and the cruel. Large urban societies will fragment themselves into tribal groups, each hostile to the other. Rural areas will be subject to pillage. The human person will be as much a prey as the beasts whom we now slaughter for food. Reason will be so clouded that man will resort for solace to the crudest and most violent forms of magic. It will be hard even for those founded most strongly in the promise of the Lord to sustain their faith and continue to give witness as they must do. Now that's Jean Marie's own destiny. Even to the end, how then must Christians comport themselves in these days of trial and terror? So there's a sense in which he's saying everybody's going to behave this way. Jean Marie aware of it, but Jean Marie still in a sense keeps faith. He still wants to send grain to the, to the starving nations. Mm-hmm. He knows that the future is sealed, but at the same time he's taking all the steps that he can possibly take to forestall the doom.
Should plan as if there's a tomorrow, but live as if the world will end tonight. You know, we always have to keep that hope that there'll always be that tomorrow, but yet each night as we go to bed, we have to prepare as if it will be our last, because we don't know when the end begins.
Hmm. We're really tired.
Well, Nadia said essentially that a couple of times. or was that your quotation on? Okay.
That was from the encyclical.
Yeah.
What Ted was reading is from the encyclical.
Yes, I
Mendelius has got a lot of questions all the way through about what the heck am I going to do with this? You know, on one hand, I want to believe the guy, but I'm afraid what this message is going to mean to the world. And you're right, that's repeated by a number of people in the book. Mm-hmm. What is it, if we just tell everybody about this, what is it going to mean?
Mm-hmm. It'll go away. Mm-hmm.
You know, what's going to happen?
That's the question of the Curia.
Mm-hmm. Well.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if we truly received an encyclical clue like that?
Well, what I think, and I think it's both true in the real world in which we live, as well as in the novel, is that the rest of the world does have the word. They didn't need the encyclical. They got it from scientific projections.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that is the reason that we're on the brink of war. He keeps mentioning the oil fields. I mean, this guy's lived through the 1970s and the Arab oil embargo and that kind of thing. And so the world does have its apocalypse, even without Jean-Marie, and that's what's happened.
Right. Yeah, I read, as I was reading again, I figured out from the dating that it was the 1990s.
Yes, that we were talking about here. I deduced that too. He said the last decade of the 20th century, I think.
It's kind of scary when you read the book how recent it is. I mean, it tells of events that just happened.
Yeah, Stu remarked about that too, because there's one thing about a Salvadoran boy back here.
Yes.
And this is awful recent here. This is too current for my comfort.
I felt the same way.
That's right.
He's
referring to the Moonies and Soka Gakri.
Right,
mm-hmm. The Moonies. And those are things that are very real, very alive. I think about the same time I was reading this is when Moon was finally convicted of tax evasion.
Mm.
And you're going, oh no.
Yeah.
I think one of the hardest things for me to deal with in terms of preparing some of the things I was doing here in terms of economics was the way in which money runs through this. You know, first, you know, his German friend is worried about how to do this, how to even get down there to see him.
Yeah.
You know, where's the money going to come from? And once he, you know, makes the arrangements to go down there and give the lectures, mm-hmm. Then what's he going to do with the body material? Well, we're going to have to print it. What happens after he prints it? He gets wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess we kind of assume that the Pope is always has access to money. Well, what happens when you're not a Pope? And he comes into money.
And the irony is, you know, what's it going to do when you get this thing out? Well, it takes money. He finds a benefactor who puts some money into it.
Mm-hmm. Or he has a father who was a rich man and settled his estate.
But the combination of that and the benefactress and the television people, the recording people, the songwriters, you know, to get a message out in today's society takes money. And I start looking at that and look at the 700 Club and go, Morris West has been watching too much television. But at the same time, no matter how you cut it, to publish Ted Peters' books, Augsburg had to put in some money. You know, it's amazing the way in which that's that one little subtle item we don't like to think about, but it's always there. And it came, you know, it kept reoccurring too often.
Well, Carl finally had the money that he could invest in that valley. The son didn't have the money to buy it. Johannes didn't have enough money to buy it. But all of a sudden, from the sale of this work, he had enough money that he can go and get that valley and do with it what he wanted to do.
That's because he had a good agent.
Yeah.
That's probably true. You know, Lars, those worldly things.
Lars Larson or something?
Who you
Lars
know Larson. And your connections. Yeah, and
some of those sweets can do things.
But the world is very much in the book. I think the chapters, when they're talking about how they're going to make Jean-Marie's message marketable, is just a riot.
Yeah. Because it's real.
And how how they get those little jingles written, and they make this book really popular, and they probably have T-shirts and, you know, beach towels and all kinds of other things with Johnny the Plumber.
I have to believe that, in part, those passages you're referring to made West's own publisher squirm a little bit. He probably described the actual conversations he had.
He may have.
Because you've had those same conversations.
Yeah, well, luckily, church publishers don't have big dollar signs in their eyes. They got little ones.
Well, I guess it paid off because this was 22 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list.
So. Oh, yes, that's right.
I mean, including advances.
Why do you think this book is 22 weeks on the bestseller list?
It's a captivating story.
I think there's a message of hope there that we all desperately want.
I think there's a lot of people who are concerned about the end times. Your whole study of Revelation.
Yes.
It's a pretty intense adventure story, truly. I mean, right in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of intensity until the last chapter, and then it's a bow-out piece.
I'm also amazed. This is a heavily theological book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's undauntedly and blatantly Christian.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, there's no subtlety
none whatsoever.
But I don't
gets
think
away
it's,
with it.
It's not pushy.
Well,
it's not a religious book. It's an adventure story with religious backing.
Yeah.
And I think that makes a difference.
Doesn't one wonder if Morris West isn't really Johnny the Clown?
Oh, I think you're right.
You know, and this
you mean
novel.
He always wanted to be Pope.
But you know, very definitely his way of sharing his theology in a very popular kind of fashion, the way Johnny the Clown was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We have some in talking with our friends at home. They said, "Mona, you got to talk with Mers. This guy's a judge in our town. He's also a friend. When they get back from vacation, sit down and talk. He has some really strange ideas about what Morris West is. I don't know what his vision is or whatever. We haven't had a chance to talk with him. I'm interested in knowing what."
The ironies are both Roman Catholic, and his wife is trained. She has all the training to be ordained as a priest.
And she's not.
And she's not. And he's a municipal judge.
Kind of eager to hear what they have to, what their perspective on the book is. It's just captivating. I had tears every time I read the end of it. I, you know, get kind of blurry-eyed.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to pull that one off because a lot of people try to somehow or other make Christ present in literary form, and it's either too melodramatic or too obvious or too subtle, one thing or the other. And it's kind of hard to bring that one off with finesse. and I thought he did as good a job as could be done.
Yeah, I love the way the New Testament is reiterated.
Oh.
You're prompted here for a reason. Even as I speak, the adversary begins to stalk the earth, roaring destruction. So in the evil times which are now upon us, you are chosen to keep the small flame of love alight, to nurture the seeds of goodness in this small place until the day when the Spirit sends you out to light other candles in the dark mm-hmm. land and plant new seeds in the blackened earth.
Pre-Pentecost, huh?
I am mm-hmm. with you now, but tomorrow I shall be gone. You will be alone and afraid, but I leave my peace with you and my love.
Oh, I missed that. That's
you will love one yeah. another as I have loved you.
That's right. Let me know before 4:00.
And then, of course, everybody's trying to remember how they're all trying to figure out with their brains, which aren't quite there anymore. Atha, Atha, what the heck? Is Atha, Atha, Maranatha. You folks forgot, you know, the Maranatha. It's the two words, Maranatha, the Lord comes.
I missed that completely.
Oh.
And then, you know, here's gathered around at this Christmas feast, everybody's thinking, well, do we believe the guy or don't we believe the guy? You know, because he's so quiet in his pronouncement about mm-hmm. who he is, you know. And he says, well, you know, what's your problem here? And Jean-Marie says, look, we've got to have a legitimizing sign. And the Lord says, look, you know, aren't all of you here together enough of a legitimizing sign? Well, I think Jean-Marie quite rightly says, hey, you know, you told us in the first place to look out for false prophets
right.
and false mm-hmm. Christs, and I'm just trying to check this out. You know,
how well, we know you could be some of the moons.
That's right, and that's what he says. He says, you know, and he has said in the encyclical, you know, there are going to be some, mm-hmm. we got a lot of problems, and there are communities called together for not altogether holy purposes. Mm-hmm. And we're not tested as a community yet. We don't know really who we are or what we're about, so you got to give us a little bit more of something here. And
flip my fleece again.
You know, and that's when he gets into the whole thing about the child. And finally Jean-Marie says, okay, I believe that you're the Son of God. And what's Mendeleev say? No, wait a minute. How can you, you know, you wanted a legitimizing sign for your own vision. How can you jump to the conclusion that this person is who he says he is? And what does he say? Carl, old friend, there's never enough evidence. You know that. You've been digging for it all your life. We make do with what we have. From this man I have had nothing but good. What more can I ask? You know, he's had mm-hmm. that encounter with him and the whole patience that he's shown with him through his therapy and so forth. Then answer, please, who am I? And then comes the proclamation. But remember, Jean-Marie also adds a disclaimer, not a real disclaimer, but he says, but I have no mission, I have no authority, I cannot speak for my friends. You will, you'll have to teach them as you have taught me. No, says Mr. Atha, tomorrow I shall be gone about my father's other business. You must teach them, Jean. Well, how can I with this halter on my tongue? You are a rock of a man, said Mr. Atha. On you I can build a small standing place for my people. Just a whole reiteration of that.
Well, he had pretty good mile to start.
All over again, you know, that whole threat of the papacy, is there a...
Oh, yeah.
Threat of Peter.
I figured the halting tongue, doesn't that refer to Moses?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, that's true, all through the story, too. You know, you got people that are saying, what'd you do this to me for? I mean, Jean-Marie is caught up with the vision, but there are other times when he's feeling in the depths and he's thinking, mm-hmm. what'd you do this to me for? You know, what the heck mm-hmm. am I supposed to do with this?
Plague on
everybody. Yeah. As a pope, he was a blessing, and now as a prophet, he's a plague. Mm-hmm.
Really wonderful models, I think, though, you know, some of the things we've been talking about.
I keep thinking about the challenge of this community, and it's a weekly challenge,
almost
a daily challenge. That every time the bus rolls in,
It brings in new people to whom one has to give warmth, comfort, and love. And every time it goes out, it takes away some of those people with whom you shared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Holden has a heck of a ministry that it's assigned to itself. It's a big job.
I can understand, like last night when they were saying, you know, come mid-August, the staff seems to get burned out. Mm-hmm. You know, how many times can you turn over love?
You should do it in a day, too.
Yeah. I mean, there's been a number of people, you know, that suddenly I see them for the first time, we sit down and talk, oh, I'm leaving tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. But better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all.
My favorite phrase now.
Remember that one?
It's when people
that
say.
Wasn't Morris West.
When people leave, I, you know, I say, well, maybe we'll see you again sometime. It's a small church.
It does not get much bigger. Well, that's true about the small church business. I talk with some people who have met people from their youth 40 years earlier here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the irony is Ned Landis, the last time I saw him was in 1964 when he graduated from Wittenberg. And we were sitting across the table and I said, my name's Ned Landis, I'm going. Don't I know you from some of this?
Had you read the book?
I can't read.
No, they don't write it in Texas.
you got to have it printed in Texas before.
No, I haven't.
It's worth reading more.
And it has a Holden Village in it.
Yeah, it does.
Well, you're glad you came late, otherwise you would have found out the ending.
Yeah.
That might be a mistake.
Yeah. How would you react if you were confronted with a man like that who told you those things and said, I am the Lord? Would you believe him? Wouldn't you want more? Aren't those the same words that some of these false prophets say? How would you know the difference?
But interesting that as a pope turned prophet, when he became prophet, he was treated just like the prophets in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was rejected and became a plague, yeah, and, you know, yeah, no one wanted to be associated with him.
When you said that, the first thought that came to me was that the last time I heard somebody say that was in a mental institution. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly, then I did an immediate flight to the curate, which is where they wanted to put the Pope.
Mm-hmm. Not long before we came, in the newspapers in our area, there was a great big ad. It was a full page ad, and I don't know, I don't remember the details of it. There were,
it's a group out of London who claims that the prophet is already here and has been living in community in various places around the globe. And they put the ad in to warn people to beware and to be ready for the coming announcement. Now, this is before the newspaper ad came out, I had been in Philadelphia and for some meeting, and on television on a talk show, there was one of the representatives of this group from England who was talking about this event. And when it takes place, all radio and television contact will be interrupted and the message will come to the whole world from God. And that's essentially what the full-page newspaper ad said. And it was simultaneously in the New York Times, Boston Globe, Washington Post, and the major city newspapers across the country. And we just kind of sat there one Sunday morning going, whoa.
Was that before or after you read the book? I think
before.
It was before we read the book. I've kind of been waiting to hear if there was any, you know, follow-up on this gigantic...
The irony is that they have never given a date in which this is going to happen, but it's supposed to happen sometime this year.
We'll miss it up here.
God will forget it, so.
It happened already. Well, some lady stopped me, she'd heard my Revelation lectures, she stopped me on the walk the other day and she says, I want to tell you a little story. about kids, and this 5-year-old kid had gone to a couple Hal Lindsey type lectures with her mother and heard all about the rapture. And the kid had a routine of coming home, and if her mother wasn't home, she would go to neighbor number one, and if that neighbor wasn't home, she'd go to neighbor number two. Well, she came home from kindergarten, she went home, her mother wasn't there, she went to neighbor number one, she wasn't there, she went to neighbor number two, she wasn't there, and was found crying on the street by a third neighbor. And she says, what's the matter? She says, I think the rapture came while I was in school and they took my mother and left me here. You raised the question about people who claim to be prophets, and I've confronted a number like that in my UFO research. And one of them was rather easy to discount. This was a fellow in Berkeley who kind of swayed as he talked. He's in telepathic communication with extraterrestrial intelligences who live in the sun. And I didn't pay too much attention to that one. On the other hand, the Unaria Society, which I'm going to talk about tomorrow, has a shamanic kind of figure, a woman in her 80s, who claims to be in constant telepathic communication with extraterrestrial intelligent life. And there's an apocalypse there too that is typical with the UFO cults. The atomic bomb is going to bring us to the brink of self-destruction. And in this case, before that happens, the UFOs will land and they will compel world peace before we destroy ourselves. Mm-hmm. And this kind of scenario is repeated again and again in the various UFO cults, and they claim superterrestrial authority for what they say. It seems to me you got to do something like testing the spirits on the basis of what the scripture says. In those kinds of situations, finally, you're left with some kind of authority of the Bible. If these claims sound preposterous, okay. You know, but as they get more and more rational and more reasonable, you got to go somewhere, you know, to find your basis. And St. Paul's little phrase, test the spirits, has come to be rather painful. Mm-hmm. What's worse, I think, is when you get people who are half in the church and half out the church, outside the church, who are making moral demands on you.
No, a little bit.
Those are the tough mm-hmm. ones, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, I'm sure that I wouldn't jump right in and say, yeah, you're the one.
Keep thinking what it would be like to be Mendelis and get the first letter.
Yeah.
And the real soul searching about whether or not you really want to do this.
You really want to believe your best friend.
Yeah.
Well, I think he could do no other.
Yeah.
Then make the next contact. He had to go the next step. That's when he had the choice.
Yeah.
That's when he had the decision to make. The first one was automatic.
And he wasn't real kind when he finally met face to face with him either. He said, I can't do what you want me to do.
I think what's helped on that point, Mendelius has got this healthy skepticism. And Jean-Marie, in a sense, is plagued by the revelation, which I think is in sharp contrast, say, from Jerry Falwell, Hal Lindsey, and other types of millennialists.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're confident, they're boisterous, they're bold, courageous, they almost relish.
They're just wallowing.
Yeah, different mood entirely, not scared at all.
Yeah.
Maybe that's getting back to the question, why do people buy this book and enjoy it? I mean, it's a self-critical book. I mean, it's a Christian book, but it's I presume West is a Catholic.
He's got to be after Shoes of the Fisherman in this back.
Yeah, if he's not a Catholic, he's in love with the Catholic Church, but he just criticized the Catholic Church.
There's a lot of history. He runs a lot of church history through it,
which is
pretty good.
But I think it's easier to get into somebody who's self-critical and share his or her world, which Hal Lindsey and Jerry Falwell are not at all self-critical.
I don't know. I heard it read before I read it.
you know, the guy from Michigan State that does the, that reads on public radio.
Mm-hmm.
He read this, and I'm building a house, so every night at 6 o'clock when he comes on the radio in our town, I'd be working, and so I'd hear bits and pieces of it while I turn on the saw, and then I don't hear it for a while. I had to read it. It is purely fascinating from word one.
Yeah.
Now that's one reason why it's good, I think, because it starts out, it's a well-written book.
Yeah, it is.
Structurally, it's great.
But it is self-critical. Remember the Friends of Silence.
Yes.
That are criticized. Yeah,
I didn't understand the Friends of. Can you explain who were they?
Well, I don't know if it ever specifically.
That's an ecclesiastical CIA.
Yeah. Right. Some higher ups in the church that were suppressing.
Anything.
Thought, really.
Yeah.
Well, don't we feel that there's some of that going on now? I mean, there are some theologians that are being quite censored in Europe.
Oh yeah, I saw that reflected in the book. Hans Tübingen, in particular.
Yeah, there's no question that he's making reference to some of that.
And there are certain things you never know about the church. As much as Cody was critiqued about his handling of finances,
yeah.
Burnaden will not be asked to justify what Cody did. Mm-hmm. He will have to live on his own record. In other words, there won't be any digging into the past.
Mm-hmm.
It'll all be from the present on. Yeah, so there is a kind of a code of silence.
Yeah.
The encyclical, I was thinking for Catholic people, and I think it, not the Catholic people I know, but a lot of Catholic people. You know, when it talks about one of the lines, I think Mendeles even throws his hands up and he says, well, now he's really said it. Because he says something about the priestly functions,
mm-hmm.
and appointing people to be teachers and preachers and carrying on the Eucharist. And, you know, with the suggestion of forgetting all that ecclesiastical route of succession and all that, you know, kind of stuff is going to be totally impractical in the times to come. And I indeed can see some Catholic people just freaking out at the suggestion
how soon?